Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Thanks for joining me today for a conversation with Yulia Frumer about her new book, Making Time, Astronomical Time Measurement in Tokugawa, Japan. This came out with the University of Chicago Press in 2018. And even though the title of the book indicates that it focuses on astronomical time measurement, and a lot of the book does look at astronomers, the work that the book does is actually much more capacious. So it's a study of changing time measurement practices over the course of a few hundred years, focusing on Japan and focusing on Tokugawa Japan in particular. But along the way, what the book is doing is offering ways to think about and practice the history of and with ideas, things, concepts, objects that have much broader significance beyond the history of Tokugawa Japan, the history of timekeeping, or the history of clocks. So in the conversation to come, you'll hear us talking about a bunch of these larger methodological and historiographical issues of concern, and they include things like, you know, what is it that we're thinking about when we think about an hour? What is it to say that two things are the same? What is it to talk about and write histories of technology transfer, right? What is it to relate the hypothetical to the actual? So there are lots of broader conceptual issues that emerge from this study that I think are particularly fascinating and interesting to think with, but also you'll hear about automata. You'll hear about some really fascinating objects and people along the way. So with that, I hope you enjoy the conversation and I hope you have a chance to take a look at the book. It's a quite beautiful object that includes, as we don't talk about in the conversation to come, but I'll mention now, it includes some really great full color images that illustrate some of the objects that come up as central actors in the course of the chapters. So get your hands on a copy, have a good read, and have a good listen. And thanks, as ever, for your support of the channel. I'm here today to talk with Yulia Frumer about their new book, Making Time, Astronomical Time Measurement in Tokugawa, Japan. Welcome to the New Books in STS podcast, Yulia. Thanks for writing such a fascinating book, and thanks also for making time to talk with me about it today. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for reading my book, and thank you for engaging with us.
Of course. So, Yulia, let's start with the traditional question for the channel, at least for my hosting of the channel. What brought you to the study of Japan and why Tokugawa Japan in particular for your area of inquiry?
It's an interesting question, and I think that a lot of people have varying answers, that there are a lot of factors, a lot of components that go into this. I would, you know, it would be easier for me to talk about how since my early age I dreamed about studying Japan, that was not the case. And it's also, some of the factors are not very intellectual. As somebody who was born in the 70s and grew up in the 80s, Japanese culture was something that was really present. So it was just interesting, it was exciting, and it's something that motivated me to study Japanese and Japanese culture in my undergraduate. But as I was progressing in my studies and began my master's, I also realized that Japan, and especially Tokugawa Japan, is intellectually interesting for me because it allowed me to test my assumptions about things that I took for granted. Just the sheer difference of certain things, certain phenomena, certain behaviors, certain events, made me realize that things that I assumed that they were natural, that things just happened this way, that it didn't have to happen this way. That realization was something that caused me just to understand that I'm studying Japan because it's fun, but also it allows me to study myself and how I think about the world and what are my assumptions about the world. Tokugawa Japan is distant both geographically and time-wise. Modern-day Japan is interesting as I'm working in modern-day Japan. And yet, because it's distant both geographically and in terms of time period, Tokugawa Japan presented me with just numerous cases that allowed me to test this assumptions about how the world works, how humans work, how devices work.
This is fascinating. And so much of, I think, what we're going to talk about in the hour to come really gets at this, right? I think more broadly, the book is really doing important work in terms of identifying at least one set of issues that many of us may take for granted, namely, what is time? What is an hour? And I'm really exploding that in a beautiful way. So we'll get to that certainly in a few moments. So for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book, I'll just say a couple of things about it and then we'll kind of move on. So the book itself looks at roughly 300 years of changes in ideas, in practices, and in technologies that were connected to time measurement in Japan. It charts, in the words of the book, a profound shift in attitude toward foreign technology between the 16th century, when European devices arrived in Japan, and 1873, when this was the era of a particularly important set of reforms when Japan abandoned its traditional temporal system, in the words of the book. Okay, so this is about time. It's about time measurement devices. It's about time technologies. Ilya, what brought you to a focus on this particular topic?
I think that was one of the cases with this realization of suddenly that things do not have to be the way that I think that they're just naturally happening. And I first heard about this really interesting time system that was used in Tokugawa period Japan when I was still in my undergraduate. And that blew my mind. The idea that one could live life with hours that change the length, that was inconceivable. How do you do that? You cannot trust hours. That this is one of the stable things in our reality. And it was just all these questions of how it is even possible of thinking about interacting with people when hours just keep changing their length. And then on top of that, there was this sense of the fact that there were clocks, there were mechanical clocks, that they're extremely beautiful, just all this brass and this just fantastic. But these clocks were adapted to measure this time in units that were not equal. And that's a conundrum for me to think about. So how would you live life under the regime of hours that change the length? And how do you make devices that measure this time?
Great. So while we're actually on the topic, Yulia, since it's come up, this is something that you talk about at length in chapter one, but just to kind of gesture there for listeners who were like, what do you mean hours are not the same length? Like, what is she talking about? You're invoking early in the conversation the idea of variable hours. Can you sort of briefly just say a little bit about what those are in Tokugawa Japan for listeners who might be like, what do you mean hours aren't the same length?
So the system, and it's I should also say that this system of time, I later discovered that it wasn't unique to Japan. It actually was used in China, it was used in Europe, but was gradually abandoned in China, probably around 10th, 11th century, and in Europe, in 13th, 14th century. And in this system, the day is divided into 12 hours. We will call them hours, 12 units. Six belong to darkness and six of light. And because the amount of light and darkness changes throughout the year with the seasons, the relative amount of time that passes within either 6 hours of darkness or 6 hours of light changes as well. So it really depends on when is dawn and sunset. Within the time of time period of darkness or light, the hours are equal. But in between them, they change with seasons. So for example, in winter, you will have quite long nighttime hours, but relatively shorter daytime hours. And in the summer, you will have really, really, really long daytime hours, but the nighttime hours will be quite short. And only about equinoxes, the hours are kind of equal, but actually even then, not entirely so.
Cool. Thank you so much. And we'll get back to this notion in a few moments and the kind of consequences of this notion, both for material culture that we're talking about, but also for how we understand technology, history, and technology transfer more globally. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the transformation between dissertation and book. So the project began as a dissertation, as I understand it, Yulia.
Yes.
And we're talking about the monograph that resulted ultimately from that research. Were there any major or significant, even if they weren't major, transformations along the way in terms of either the shape and the scope of the project and or the way that you were conceptualizing it?
I think that there were quite a lot of changes, both in terms of just writing. I rewrote quite a lot of it, even if it was the same material, that there were quite a lot of rewriting done. I added the chapter, a whole chapter 6 on Endo Bakonori. This was completely new. And another thing that, and of course, I had to cut out a lot of materials. And that's, I know that it always happens, just when you do research and for dissertation, there's just so many interesting things and you just want to put everything in writing. But then eventually you need to decide what are the things that they contribute to your argument and what are things that they may be interesting but not necessarily belong in this book. And I had to cut these things out. But one of the, I think, a transformative things about framing the concept of the book was came when I talked to a friend and I talked about my project, and the friend said something about the time with a capital T, and it really only then hit me that we are so used to this idea that time is with a capital T, that something exists there, that it's a given, and it was not given in Tokugawa Japan. And especially before 1830s, 1840s, people were really, really comfortable with having several kind of times. Even astronomers who were dealing with Western time measurement, everybody was comfortable with having different systems. But that was no longer true with the transformation to the modern time. In the Meiji period, or at least among people who initiated the reform. And this is something that I emphasize as much, much stronger in the book that was not as emphasized in the dissertation.
Great. Thank you so much. So now let's dive right in. And we're going to dive in by starting it in the introduction. One of the larger contributions of the book is that it offers, in the words of the book, a fresh interpretation of the ways that societies evaluate and attach meanings to technologies. So in other words, this is a book that focuses, at least in my from my perspective, right, it focuses on a very particular case to make some larger contributions to how we think about, write about, and work with some larger historiographical issues. And history of technology is one of those larger issues. So the book shows how the conceptualization of timepieces in Japan transformed and evolved as a result of transformations in the broader range of associations related to the measurement of time. And again, this is in the words of the book, the broader range of associations related to the measurement of time. I'm emphasizing the word associations here because that winds up being really important in a way that listeners might not otherwise realize. So again, in the words of the book, in order to adapt foreign timekeeping technology to their needs, Japanese users first needed to integrate it into their web of associations related to practices of time measurement. And so they did this either by modifying the tech to better suit those associations or by changing the associations to fit the tech. So in other words, the broader claim here is that the assessment of technology is tied to the broader associations that it invokes. Okay, so Yulia, can you talk a little bit about the significance of this argument? What is this arguing against, or what kind of historiographical trends or arguments is this usefully changing or complicating, and why is it important from your perspective to change or complicate those arguments in this way?
I think that there are implications for both the kind of conceptual world that we are dealing with, the world of abstract concepts such as time, and also to the very, very material level of technology, and in fact, something that can bridge the relationship between the intellectual world and the material world that we are immersed in. And in the case of technology, in technology of science, we spend a lot of times thinking about the needs of users and the relationship between the ways that somebody who designed an instrument thought that this instrument would be used, and how when users, they take it and suddenly they realize that they have different needs and they need something to do something different with the device. So the word, the term needs is very, very essential for understanding how users interact with technology. Mm-hmm. And yet for me, what I discovered was that need is much more complicated than some practical activity. And we can talk, for example, with clocks, we can talk about the need to measure time. But when I looked at my sources, when I looked in the way that people talked about their time measurement practices, and also in the ways that the Japanese clockmakers modified mechanical clockwork mechanism, I realized that the need also includes a broader situational feeling. Even we can talk about feelings. So the need is not only for time, for a timepiece to measure time. The need is for a timepiece to measure time in a way that feels comfortable for users. And this feels comfortable, feels familiar. That's part of how this world of association that is now tied to new timepiece is working for the user.
So this is really interesting, and this relates to what I wanted to ask you about next, which is the way that the book also is contributing to, is changing how we think about the relationship between Europe and Tokugawa Japan, right? So what you just said is very much emphasizing, at least for me and how I'm hearing it, the importance of feeling, of comfort, of familiarity. This is not a story about the appropriation of a technology all along the path of appropriation as a result of the desire to appropriate things that come with a particular foreign cultural context. We're going to see how once we get into the mid-19th century, the adoption of certain kinds of technologies is going to be about the adoption of the associations that it evokes. And this is about a certain idea of enlightenment. This is about other kinds of cultural ideas. But for most of the story, it's not about that. And the book argues that this case study offers a rare opportunity to look at in detail how foreign technology was interpreted in the absence of knowledge of its original cultural context. So yes. Can you talk a little bit about that and its importance to you, Yulia?
The interesting case here is historically when clocks are imported to Japan, and very soon after the Europeans are banished from Japan. So there is not as much interaction. There is some heritage of interaction with Europeans from the 16th century, but very soon there is not much knowledge about how were European devices used in Europe and what kind of work were these devices doing for people in Europe. And clockmakers in Japan are left alone to try to come up with ways of how to adapt this foreign mechanism that was kind of nonsensical to them because it didn't measure time properly from their perspective. They were left alone to think about the ways of what to do with this material that they have in hand. Mm-hmm. And the possibilities, the kind of the things that they came up with, they're really, really creative. And that shows that the designs that they came up with, they point out that time measurement is really not just about practicalities. It's not the fact that Western technology was better in some sense. In fact, European clocks, and especially those in the 16th century, they could hardly be taught as much better in terms of being punctual. But the better for people is how well it suits into their understanding how time works and how the measurement of time works.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. So as we move into the book, right, we're going to see this set of arguments developed. We also see a number of other historiographical arguments proposed and developed. And we've talked about some of those already in the conversation so far. So chapter one chronicles the development of timekeeping practices across the Tokugawa period, and it makes a number of historiographical arguments, some of which we've already talked a little bit about. It begins asking the question, what is an hour? Right? Which seems really simple. We've already talked about the fact that the seeming simpleness of this is actually hiding a very, very complex history. And this chapter introduces the idea of variable hours, which you've already really helpfully talked about for us. Now, the chapter importantly challenges a common characterization of variable hours as more, quote, natural, right? As a more natural system. This is important from my perspective for a number of reasons that push back at some prevailing tendencies that characterize the history of science, technology, and medicine globally and characterize the way we talk about the relationship between local practices, for example, in what we call Europe and what we do not call Europe. But for you, Yulia, why and how is it significant to push back against an argument or an assumption that these variable hours in Japan are more natural?
I think a part of it, and this is something that obviously was not in the book, is my interaction with my colleagues, mm-hmm. some of my colleagues, when talking about my research, and especially people who do not deal with Japanese history, historians of science and technology in Europe, focused on Europe, when I was telling them about the system of hours in the Tokugawa period, oftentimes the response was, well, maybe they just didn't need to measure time. Maybe they just lived the kind of life that they were agrarian and they just didn't need to do so. And that is absolutely not true. They really measured time a lot and they needed time measurement for a variety of bureaucratic reasons. It was a highly bureaucratic society even in 16th, 17th century. And And there is a particular moment when that people latch onto when they talk about the naturalness, the supposedly naturalness of variable hours, and that is that the day begins with the dawn. That the definition, the length of hours is dependent on when is the dawn. And that is decided by something that occurs in nature, that's seasons. It's not a man-made construct, supposedly. It's something that happens, that we can all see that it changes throughout the year. But here's the interesting point, is that dawn is not a natural point that exists in nature. It gets bright long, long time before sunrise, and we modern people oftentimes we don't get up early enough to actually witness this, but it does, and life begins and activity begins before sunrise. Even if we took sunrise as a starting point for the day, still there would be complications about how do you define sunrise. But in fact, we don't even go by sunrise. We go by when it starts to be bright enough to have activities. Mm-hmm. And that's a long process. And there is nothing natural that could be used in order to define it. And this is where human decision comes. A society needs to come together and agree that this is the point that we all decide that would be the beginning of the day. And there's another point that we all decided that would be the end of the day, where there's a similar process, a gradual process. And in Japan, there were bureaucratic mechanisms that government employed astronomers to calculate this and to create calendars and to distribute this. And that, once we understand this, that there is a whole government apparatus involved into determining this point that maybe we perceive as natural, that point was not natural at all. That was, in fact, a kind of, from the point of view of people who lived in Tokugawa Japan, that was a very, very sign of civilization, that the society can come together and make the system to decide how do we manage our time.
Awesome. And more generally, the book really does argue for understanding time and its histories in terms of human-made conventions, right? It argues that, again, in the words of the book, before the 19th century, time measurement was understood to be a human-made convention. And it also argues and shows, I think, very compellingly, even in this first chapter, that several different modes of measuring time coexisted and could be used for different purposes. Now, interestingly, sometimes it was exactly the factors that might seem now to be incompatible with like modern life and lifestyles that, as you show here, encouraged and enabled the sorts of timekeeping that we now tend to associate with modernity, like synchronicity, right? Synchronization. Yeah, yeah. And the kinds of awareness of and practices of time that go with that. So this is really interesting. And early in the book, you give us a lot of examples of some of these different timekeeping devices, and we won't have time to talk about them in detail, but I just want to mention them for listeners. They include time bells with their auditory signals. They include incense clocks and other kinds of mechanical clocks. So what a clock is even in this book, just like what an hour is opened up, what a clock is also opened up really productively. So as we get to chapter two, and we could talk for another 3 hours about chapter one, right? There's a lot more going on in chapter one, but chapter two is making a really interesting set of points, set of arguments, I think, about material culture and objects and thinginess and how we pay attention to them in history and how others have paid attention to them in history as well. This chapter focuses on Japanese clockmakers' modifications to European devices in order to measure variable hours. So the chapter is really concerned with the thinginess of clocks. This manifests in a couple of ways. One of the ways this manifests is by looking at Japanese clockmakers' own interpretations of the thinginess of European clocks. And you show here, I think compellingly, that they experienced European clocks' thinginess according to their own existing associations with time measurement. And we've talked a little bit about this notion of associations and its significance. But the chapter also manifests its interest in materiality in terms of how you are using these clocks as historical sources. So, Yulia, what were kind of materially some of the most interesting kinds of clocks for you to work with? And can you talk a little bit about your own sense of the importance of these objects as a kind of historical document?
Yeah, absolutely. The clocks are wonderful. They are really, really beautiful. And there's a tendency today to see these clocks as objects of art, because those that survived were really most of them are more expensive and people were reluctant to throw away. But in fact, these were much more common than just the rich and the important daimyos. The interesting thing about them, and they're all really, really beautiful, is that even though that Japanese clockmakers had this mechanism and they needed to adapt it to make it measure time in variable hours, so there is this need. So obviously, the modification was inspired by the need to make them measure time properly in Japanese terms. But the ways that clockmakers came up with ideas of how to modify were really, really different. So they came up with designs that really didn't look like each other, and some of them didn't look like European clocks at all. So for me, the interesting part is to identify not only why they were measuring time in variable hours, but how. And it seemed that for clockmakers, when I look at the structure and the design of the clock, for clockmakers, it was not just a matter of making clocks measure time in variable hours, but to make clock measure time in this matter similar to some non-mechanical timekeepers. And I look at the way time moves on timekeeper, at the way that digits are distributed on timekeepers, at the kind of practices that one needed to engage with this, with the timekeeper, the modified timekeeper, to try to see what are the similarities to other practices that people had with non-mechanical clocks. And one example, the distribution of digits on a dial. We used to think of 12 o'clock, midnight, and midday as something that is on top of the dial. But in Japanese clocks, the hour of rat, which is what they corresponding to midnight, that was placed at the bottom. That's curious. Mm-hmm. So I would ask, why? Why did they place the hour of rat at the bottom and not at the top? Why did they need to make this modification? And the reason is that here there's a convention of actually compass, geographical directions, and map making. And a really, really long history that starts in China, where the north that is associated with the winter and also with the midnight hour ends with this letter rat, with this digit rat. The north is always placed at the bottom. And if we look at a lot of Chinese maps, look at a lot of Japanese maps, and especially before the 18th century, we see that the map is drawing that the north is at the bottom of the page. So this orientation, north-south orientation, is then superimposed on the dial of the clock, where digits are associated with directions, with cardinal directions. Another great example that I really, really like is this interesting clock that is just a stick. It's vertical, and time doesn't move circularly on this dial, but rather it just goes top-bottom. And again, then I would ask, why would you arrange this in such a way? And the idea of time that moves circularly, it sounds really natural to us, because we see it on clocks and in the movement of shadows. But for Japanese clockmakers, one of the practices that they had to engage is also with water clocks, with namans, with sundials. And when you have a naman, the sundial, And the shadow, even though that the shadow moves around it, the shadow of a tree or the shadow of a phenomenon itself, the measurement stick on it, when we have the measures, we see the shadow moves up and down this measurement rod itself. So the clockmakers, Japanese clockmakers in Tokugawa period, were trying to replicate this movement of the shadow on measurement rod underneath the namen on the mechanically positioned, mechanically operated clock that they made up, and they called it a measurement rod clock, a shadow clock.
Mm-hmm. So one of the ways that this is actually really, really interesting is the way in which it's related to one of the other points that you're making in this chapter, right? So you ask, or you make a point in this chapter that this understanding this period in the history of clocks and clockmakers in Japan can usefully complicate or change how we understand technology and knowledge transfer. And one of the reasons why is that I think as you show here and you raise this as a kind of provocative question at the end of this chapter, how a single thing is understood in different contexts maybe or perhaps makes it into another kind of thing, right? And you ask, is it the same tech when it moves, right? So in what sense? So basically this raises the question, what is it to be the same? Which for me poses really interesting methodological questions around what it is we're doing as historians when we take this thing, right? And we are then interacting with it. To what extent are we interacting with the document or the object or whatever it is that we're using to try to get a sense of another time and place as the same thing as it was in the other time and place? Do you see what I mean? So it's I don't think there's an answer to that, but I think it's a really important and really productive question to think with. So I just wanted to raise that to thank you for posing that question at the end of this chapter, because I think we tend to not think enough about what it is to be the same. And it's this really, really important methodologically as well as historically. So as we move to the next chapter, we move to a chapter that looks specifically at the timekeeping practices of Tokugawa astronomers. Now, this chapter shows the ways in which changing mathematical methods produced new sets of associations that were relevant to the measurement of time and thus were really crucial for this history. In the 18th century, we see this change beginning in a narrow circle of astronomers who began seeing time as a reflection of celestial motion, and then we see this expanding out of this circle of astronomers. So, Yulia, why astronomers? For you and for this study, especially for listeners who may not be familiar with this context, what makes astronomers so important and so helpful for understanding the history of time in Tokugawa Japan?
So I would like to preface my answer with going a little bit back to the first chapter. And the reason that I bring astronomers into the picture is first thinking in terms of how Tokugawa society functioned with this variable hours and with this wonderful set of clocks and other non-mechanical timekeepers. And one of the things that I really stress in chapter one is that the system worked. It worked wonderfully. And it worked throughout the changes that happened in the Tokugawa period. Obviously, things were really, really different in early 17th century and mid-19th century. But even as Japan became more and more industrialized and had operations in mines and huge cities and multi-million megapolis of Edo, that system satisfied the needs of the people, the bureaucratic needs, the work needs, the communication needs, that worked. So why abandon this? Why change? So there was change somewhere, but not in the actually in the labor dynamic, in the measurement dynamic of bureaucratic needs. There was change somewhere. And I identify this change, first of all, in astronomers' practices. And astronomers are important because they are the people who interacted with time the most during that period. They were the ones who needed to design calendars. So they needed time measurement as a part of their practice, because that's how that's one of the data that they gather in order to calculate celestial motion. They measure it in time. On the other hand, they are also produce time because they are the ones who make calendars. So they tell people how to measure time and how to divide their days into day hours and night hours. And astronomers are oftentimes have this a little bit of a bad rep of being detached from society, especially because they sit in their towers and their observations and then somewhere high above and they look at the skies and they don't look below. But that is a misleading impression. These people are very much enmeshed in the living, breathing society, and they're part of this. And with their understanding of time differently, they also created, they had an output where they had different ideas about how their output is going to look like. So they were in a position to actually make change happen.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So for listeners who are particularly interested in the details of what you were just describing, Chapter 3 offers lots of them. And so I'll just very, very briefly mention, just in terms of understanding the overall arc, pun intended, of this story. I don't have time to talk in detail about it, but just to give a sense of what's in the chapter. So the astronomers that you're looking at begin timing segments of paths traversed by celestial bodies, and they begin drawing diagrams in which measured time stood for arcs describing moving planets. So they begin seeing time and depicting time in various material forms in terms of arcs and angles rather than as sequences of temporal points. And this becomes really important, right? You show here how their practices gradually came to include more European elements, including trigonometry, including calculation using diagrams, maps, and sextants, and pendulums, and their associations changed as well. And this chapter takes us into the ways in which their timepieces changed as a result and the importance of those changes. Now, one of the ways in which these changes and these associations became really important is the way in which they were manifest, not just in timepieces, but also in terms of mapping of not just the land, but also efforts to map the seas. And this was really formative for shaping the story that unfolds in the second part of the book. So the fourth chapter looks in particular at the ways that astronomers' new approaches made their way into geography and also surveying, and eventually manifested in a new map format. So Yulia, there's so much that we could talk about here, right? This chapter is really extraordinarily rich. It's one of a couple of chapters that focus on a particular figure to take us into the kind of texture of and the details of very particular cases within this case. For you, what is perhaps most interesting about the story of the way these timepieces and this work by the astronomers manifest in terms of cartography, right? And is there anything about that you're particularly excited about, right? So put another way, but more succinctly, what do you think is most interesting about the way that these time measurement practices manifest in mapping and cartography specifically?
I think that one of the things that was exciting for me when I was doing this research is noticing how my actors themselves, they didn't know what kind of changes they're bringing. And it seems almost accidental. There are so many places that they were almost accidental. The whole cartography, and there were changes in Japanese cartography already that taking place that were both in terms of expanding the areas of mapping and modifying different means and techniques of mapping. But here, this particular project, it all began with just a really esoteric kind of problem that the head astronomer, Takahashi Hitoki, was facing. And that is like, that just his calculation didn't make sense. There was some kind of mistake and he needed to identify the mistake. He looked at some Western books. He couldn't read Dutch, but he could read tables. And in these tables, it looked like they were suggesting that the length of degrees changed as you move from equator to the North Pole. And he operated on the assumption that the Earth was a sphere, that the whole calculation, trigonometrical calculations, all this like spherical geometry that you build in this calculation is based on the fact that we assume that the Earth is a sphere. But here, there was this information that is coming. And it was weird. And in a Western book that he read, not only that it seemed that the length of 1 degree of meridian changes as we go from equator to North Pole, but it's also the Western book made it present as if there was a bulge around the equator. And that completely did not make any sense to Takahashi Ishitoke. And he sent his student, Inota Tadataka, to measure the length of 1 degree of meridian on the ground and to see, okay, we finally need to find out the value and to know what's going to happen. So that began the whole project that then just started unfolding. And because this was basically astronomical conundrum, as Inota Tadataka was taking measurements, terrestrial measurements, and doing surveying as surveyors and at his time did as well, he was also establishing these observation stations every couple of days where they would stay and at night and doing celestial observations. And that's where a lot of changes occur because of this practice of measuring time and carrying this really, really heavy and kind of convoluted pendulum clock and setting it every day. Every time that we need to make an observation station, that is all a product of this tiny, weird conundrum that his teacher had. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. And it's super, super helpful too. And some of what you just mentioned comes up importantly, and I think is an important part of the nature of the argument that you're putting forth in the next chapter. But first, I just want to kind of signal for listeners, part of what's happening in chapter 4, this chapter on cartography and geography, is that you're showing in interesting ways the ways in which maps that are published based on these measurements you described revolutionize the perception of Japan's space, right? And elsewhere in the book, we also see how some of these scholars, some of these astronomers, some of the people that you're looking at are dealing with issues of geography and cartography as well when they're using or working from Chinese texts, which have an assumption of a kind of space centered on Beijing, and they're interested in thinking with Japanese space, right? So the the kind of conceptions of space, the way this manifests as also a history of the way space is conceptualized, is also part of this story about time.
Absolutely. And time and space are so inherently interlinked in the way that we conceptualize them, but also the way that we use them. And particularly in cartography, that's a very, very important important aspect, because space is measured in time. Time is oftentimes as a proxy to a measurement of space. And here it also has a political and ideological significance when once everything is tied by the way of comparing time measurements between all the different places in Japan that the surveyors were taking, by comparing to a central space, which then it wasn't the observatory in Edo, it was Kyoto, it created the sense that all the different places in Japan, by the way of measurement, were then tied to Kyoto, which is the heart of Japan, the center of Japan. And once there is a map where all the coordinates are placed along the grid of longitudes and latitudes that are now centered on Kyoto, they put the prime meridian to run through Kyoto, then the whole Japan becomes centered on this city that is considered to be the cultural heart of Japan.
Absolutely. And we could also tell a story about, and if we had another 3 hours, I would love to talk about this, and because I know you're the right person to talk to about this, but we could also tell a story about how now we tend to treat time, our time as a kind of space, right? I mean, with like iCal programs, we map time, we occupy time, we treat it as a kind of colonial almost or imperial resource to be occupied. And that's a whole other story. So time and space, that's a conversation that I think will be ongoing after this podcast between you and I. And I'm going to remind you of this next time I see you. But also one of the things that you mentioned offhand and talking about just the physicality, the heaviness of these clocks that are carted around becomes really important in the story that chapter 5 tells. And we won't have time to talk about this in detail, but chapter 5 tells a story about, among other things, the way in which this engagement with time and land space manifests in an effort to understand sea space, right? So there's a really interesting story here about the way that the need for astronomical data led Tokugawa astronomers to use British nautical almanacs and the kind of consequences of efforts to translate land methods to the sea. And that has to do, among other things, with the challenges of using the kinds of clocks that you could count on, relatively speaking, to be stable on land. You can't count on that kind of stability on the sea, and that has all kinds of implications that wind up resulting in a very different attitude toward Western clocks to nautical almanacs that's going to play out in the next few chapters. But I can't in good conscience not ask you about something that comes up in chapter 7. So we're going to skip over chapter 6, time measurement on the ground, because I have to ask you about automata. And I have to make sure that we have time to do this. Okay, so once we get through chapter 5 and the story that I just described, and then chapter 6, which also looks at and focuses on the work of another individual whose work, as you show, exemplifies the reach of astronomers' changing conceptualization of time measurement and looks at the ways, among other things, that different kinds of timepieces measure different kinds of time, gives us a really cool story about a Russian clock. So that's all in chapter 6, but then we get to chapter 7. Okay. Chapter 7 focuses on the dissemination of ideas about time measurement by clockmakers. So clockmakers in this case served as go-betweens. They were the ones who explained to the public the principles on which Western clocks and watches were based. They were the ones adjusting the gears of European mechanisms to work in a different mode. They were the first to understand how to translate between the European conventions of timekeeping and the Japanese conventions of timekeeping. And they published treatises and guides to teach their readers about European clocks. So this is a really interesting chapter about them. Part of this chapter looks at the importance of automata to this story. And I feel like I need to ask you about this, Yulia. So what are automata for listeners who are like, what is that word? And why do they become important to this history of time and timekeeping?
Well, automata are robots. These are dolls, mechanical dolls that they move with internal mechanism, and some of them write, some of them shoot an arrow from a bow, others climb stairs, sing, perform what we would perceive as human activities. Mm-hmm. And humans were fascinating with trying to recreate humans by different means throughout the history. Like we know it from ancient times in Greece and in China. In early modern period, and that is true both in Japan and in Europe, there was a really, really close connection between automata makers and clock makers, because automata are operating on a clockwork mechanism. And the kind of skills that masters needed in order to actually make these mechanical dolls work and create impression that they move in a human-like manner, these were skills that required a very, very a master of clockmaking. So they needed somebody who didn't just know how to build clocks, but who knew how to build exceptionally good clocks. And these were clockmakers that worked with astronomers. And a lot of clockmakers, a lot of automata makers that I mentioned in these chapters, at a certain point of their life, they also made astronomical measurement instruments. And oftentimes they acquired new skills by making astronomical instruments, but oftentimes they also, by learning how to make dolls move in a human-like manner, they honed the skills of clockmaker, of making clocks that they're very, very precise, and they're able to keep time for a long period of time, like Tanaka Hisashige, the famous clockmaker that I mentioned in the chapter, who built this fabulous, what they call the forever clock, the 10,000-year clock, that displayed different dials that they manifested different kind of times, but all of them, he made it so masterfully that all of these dials were connected to just one single mechanism that was operating the clock and the kind of like model of astronomical motion that was positioned on top, and that's the device that is featured on the cover of my book. So automata makers are important because the skills that are required in making automata and the skills that are required in making really, really precise clocks are really, really the same skills.
So cool. I love this. And also this is, I think, an example, depending on how we look at the significance of these automata makers and their kind of contributions to the story. It's an example of, I think, a larger point that the book makes elsewhere, not just in this chapter, of the significance of thinking with and thinking about the relation between the imagined and the real, right? And so this is an example, I think, of a larger phenomenon in which you're showing us and you're asking us to think elsewhere in the book about the relationship between the hypothetical thought experiments, the imagination, and actual life. And I think this is a, maybe not obviously, but it's a manifestation of the way in which the creation of this sort of imagined being, right, this automata, is very much rooted in a history of how we get to notions of actual time, right, and like what that means to us experientially and historically. So I just want to also put a pitch in to the conversation for the attention that you're placing on the real effects of imagination and hypothesis and thought experiments in the book. And so I just love that, the imagination and the real and their relationship. So, but by chapter 8, right, we're almost now at the conclusion of our conversation, and we are almost at the conclusion of the book. By chapter 8, we finally get to these reforms that I mentioned right at the beginning of the conversation. These are 1873 reforms where the Japanese government decides to convert the whole country to Western-style timekeeping. So as a way to kind of wrap up this part of the book, this part of the conversation, Yulia, can you say a little bit about these reforms and their significance for listeners? You make a point here that this is ultimately about the associations that the old and new systems of timekeeping evoked, and that's where this transition came from. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The reforms came just a couple of years into a major period, and it is very, very tempting for us to assume that the reforms were needed because there were new things going on. There was new technologies, there were factories, there were telegraphs, there were railroads. And the intellectuals like Fukuzawa Ikeji, who promoted the reform, they made it seem as this is the big new thing that we need in order to be civilized in Western country. But in fact, when we look at this, when the reforms came out, the material transformations of railroads and telegraphs, they were just beginning. They were not much different from what was in the end of the Tokugawa period. And what's more important is that the discussions about the necessity of reform, they began much, much earlier. And we see that even in the end of the 18th century. So it couldn't have been that the reform was motivated by the changes in Meiji period. Rather, it was a broader thought of what kind of calendar we need, what kind of time measurement we need, and what do we think that we're doing by measuring time. And what we see from the late 18th century and throughout the first half of the 19th century are a lot of intellectuals, a lot of them studying astronomy or interacting with astronomers, sending them letters, who say that astronomers need to be our models because astronomers are rational, they're mathematical, and yes, they employ Western time. And they start talking about local practices, practices of divination, with a lot of disdain. And they say, we don't want that. That is not how rational people need to do. We want a rational utilitarian government that utilizes sciences, astronomy, geography, and navigation in order to create a better society. And reform in ours is kind of a victim of this larger reform in calendrical system, the abandonment of the lunar solar calendar of that takes into account both the movement of the sun and the moon, disposing it all in favor of the Gregorian calendar, and also the hours. And the hours get abandoned by associations because they remind people, because the use of the animal, the zodiac animal signs, of all these practices that they now think of like something that is backward. And there are not the kind of time that astronomers use, that now astronomers become the model for the whole society. And that's an interesting point, because prior to, let's say, 1810s, 1820s, astronomers themselves didn't think that they're the mode of time that they're measuring, that there was something special about this. They themselves, they had several systems that they kind of juggled in between. And when they went home, they did something completely else. And that was fine. They thought that they would just adjust whatever system fits best, the kind of time measuring that they needed to the situation. That was plain. However, in 1830s and 40s, when they see this changing of discourse, suddenly astronomers have only one kind of time that they're using, and that's the Western time. And the people who learn from them, the intellectual who see them as a model, they now say that this time that is part of astronomical system, the fact that is no longer related to human practices, but is measured by the celestial motion, by the movement of the Earth around the sun, that is the real time. That is the time. And we associate this with the progress, rationality, astronomy, mathematics, everything that now we think that civil society needs to have.
Awesome. Yulia, you've done such an amazing job opening up this book for us. And the book is so rich and there's so much in there. And I just want to thank you for everything that you've done in the course of this conversation and in the book. We're now at the conclusion of our conversation, and there's so much more that we could be talking about. But in the absence of time to do that, you know, as fully as I would love, is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but you think might be important for listeners to know?
Absolutely. As we were talking, especially about chapter 3 that talks about transformation in the ways that astronomers talk and measure time, one of the important things that I wanted to stress is that this is not a simple story of transition of Western science to Japan. And that story has been told a lot of adoption of Western practices, adoption of Western instruments. But here, I want to emphasize that even though that in the end, Japanese astronomers did take a lot from Western science that came via China, the very reason that they became interested in Western astronomy was their engagement with ancient Chinese texts. When they were exposed to some kind of popular astronomy in the 17th century, several of Japanese astronomers said, well, that sounds nice, the way that we talk, but there's no mathematics. Like, I mean, that makes sense, but I cannot do anything with this because there's no data. But in Chinese texts, there's data. And because in Chinese texts, there were some problem-solving methods that Nathan Stephen calls them kind of proto-trigonometry, then Japanese astronomer said, "We heard that in China, there are now mathematicians that they deal with this problem and they help us solve it mathematically." And through this mathematical conundrums of some kind of methods that they were going towards trigonometry, they became interested in Western astronomy in general. And then another interesting point towards the end of the 18th century is that because Japanese astronomers were learning astronomy, Western astronomy from the Chinese Jesuits, basically, the kind of system that they first learned was a Tychonian hybrid, which was not heliocentric, but a kind of a system in which all the planets rotate around the sun, but sun rotates around the earth. And in Western history, a lot was talked, the famous Thomas Kuhn book talks about how important this scientific revolution of changing perspective from geocentrism to heliocentrism, how important that was for science and for development of Western culture. But this is not what happened in Japan. In Japan, after astronomers engaged with the Kanyon model, which was not heliocentric, at a certain point, towards the end of 18th century, they received more books that did talk and did present the movement of the planet as heliocentric. And they said, oh yeah, that makes sense. It was not a big revolution. There wasn't a huge change of minds. They just accepted this as natural. That was not something traumatic that they experienced. What was really, really important, what was revolutionary, was Kepler's law, especially laws that state that the movement of planets is, the orbits are not spherical, but elliptic. That caused a major break in the way that calculations were made. So I guess that what I wanted to emphasize in these two stories, that the first encounter and the continuous encounter with Western astronomy, that it's not about immediate assumption that Western astronomy was better, because it was not better all the time. And it's not about the transformation from geocentric viewing of the Earth to heliocentric. It was more about the actual mathematical calculation methods that astronomers found reasonable or not reasonable.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And now, Yulia, that the book is out, what is next for you? What are you currently working on?
I am currently working on the history, of the long history of Japanese humanoid robots that began with that very automata that we talked a little bit a couple of minutes ago. And it may seem like a real departure from what I was doing in this book that we're discussing now, because even though that the humanoid robots, the history does begin even before 19th century, and I do spend some time in the 19th century, the bulk of the book focuses on 20th century and even on the second half of the 20th century. So it looks like I'm doing something a little different. I'm moving to robots and not clocks, and I'm moving from early modern Japan to modern Japan. But in fact, there are a lot of places where the two projects intersect. And the first one is really the just in terms of research, because when we start in the 19th century, people who were really, really important for automata making and humanoid automata making are the people who work with astronomers and people who create this wonderful box. So as I was doing research about clock making and astronomical clocks, I also encountered a lot of materials about automata making. The other really important connection between two projects is that I basically ask a similar kind of question. Because in the book about clocks and timekeeping, I ask, we have this abstract notion of time, but what is it that help us understand what time is? What are the material anchors that we use in order to create our own concept of time and time measurement? And I do something very, very similar with automata, because humanoid automata is based on their creator's idea of what humanity is. So I ask how humanoid automata manifest the creator's ideas of humanity. What are the kind of hierarchies that when an engineer or an automata maker wanted to recreate a human-like characteristic in their device. How did they construct the hierarchy of attributes, of characteristic, human characteristic, which they thought that the most important that they needed to put in a machine to make this machine look human? So in this sense, these projects are really, really, first of all, the current project is growing out of the research that I've done in the book on the clocks, but it's also conceptually recreates the similar set of questions and identifies similar set of problems, and also logically looks at the automata as a kind of text, historical text that I can analyze in order to arrive at the engineer's conceptions of humanity and human likeness.
Well, that sounds amazing too, Yulia. So let's make a date to talk about that when that book is out, which also sounds fascinating. And in the meantime, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me about your book today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for talking to me and for all of your insightful questions.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us, and come back and check us out again next time.